So my lecture tonight is called Living with Longing in a Fallen World. Some of you may, those of you who pay attention to our lecture schedule, may have noticed that this lecture was on our schedule for last term. For winter term, I was originally supposed to do it then, but had a death in the family that week. So I had to go away, so Sarah covered for me. So I'm here I am now, finally, at long last, giving this lecture. As is often the case with LaBrie lectures, we pick our topics far ahead of the time that we actually start working on lectures. I've been thinking about doing something on longing for a long time, and finally decided to take it on. I will be honest and say that when we canceled the lecture last term, I was really relieved. This has been a hard, This has been like a wrestling match for me. But here I am, presenting something to you. But I think it's a hard question that many of us wrestle with. I'm assuming because you're here tonight, maybe you do too, that it resonates with you on some level. But this question of how are we supposed to live with longing and with unmet desire? When I've mentioned to people that I'm doing this lecture, most of the time the response has been like, oh, why are you doing that? And that's kind of how I feel as well. Desire is really tricky business, and it's a topic that's both heavy and fragile at the same time, that I've found. Most people don't really know what to do with desire. It's hard to hold and hard to get our minds around, I think, especially as Christians. I want to give the disclaimer here that I don't have any hard and fast answers or solutions to this question of living with desire. The title of my lecture probably should have started with a few thoughts on living with longing in a fallen world, because this is such a struggle for me. And I don't think I do a particularly good job of living with longing well, whatever that looks like. So this lecture was really a way of trying to offer myself help as much as anything that you'll take away from it, so we can navigate this together. I'm really looking forward to the discussion time, because I want you to help me too. Although I use the word longing in my title, I'm going to be using the words longing and desire interchangeably. I think we currently do have different connotations for these words in our culture now, but they actually really do mean the same thing for all intents and purposes. The dictionary definition of desire is to wish or long for, to crave or to want. The definition of longing is strong, persistent desire or craving. So they are used to define each other. As I started thinking about the concept of desire and started talking to others about it, a number of other associated emotions and ideas came to mind. Just to get my mind flowing, I made a sort of a word map. I don't know if you remember doing this in school. I don't know how well you can read this. This is just me taking a picture of the notes that I made with my terrible handwriting. I'm not going to talk about all of these tonight, but these are just some connected concepts that kind of came to mind. So I've got longing and desire in the middle. Disappointment, cynicism, faith, lament, hope, ambition, fear, passion, sentimentality, motivation, prayer, anticipation, dreams, happiness, worship, shame, love, apathy, trust, change, risk, transformation, commitment, addiction, depression. I'm sure you could probably think of some others as well that connect for you. To me, desire and longing sort of feel like an umbrella with all of these other really closely related things tightly packed underneath. I'm not going to be touching on all of these tonight, but you'll probably sort of hear them come up in different ways as I'm talking. Last term, when I was originally trying to tackle this, I did a very informal poll of some of my friends and also our LaBrie students. So a few of them are here that were with me last term. I asked them if the words desire and longing had negative or positive connotations for them. The overwhelming response was negative, that those are negative words to people. Most people I talked to associated desire and longing with something difficult or a struggle or being unfulfilled. One woman said that she preferred the word anticipation because it implies assurance that what we long for will be granted to us. But I think that's exactly what makes desire and longing so hard. There's no guarantee. Anticipation is not the same thing. Going back to my title, I'm talking about the concept of living with longing in a fallen world. And by this, I'm referring to the fall of man as laid out in the first couple chapters of Genesis, when Adam and Eve disobeyed God by eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and their relationship with God was broken. However, the fall really has four significant implications for us. We now have a broken relationship with God. We have broken relationships with other people. We have broken relationships with ourselves, with the self. And we have a broken relationship with the natural and the created world. We often talk at Libri about how we live under the shadow of the fall. That these broken relationships are a reality for each one of us every day. I'm not going to spend much time talking about the fall itself tonight, but I just want to kind of give you that as the context for the title and under which I'll be talking about our human longings and desires. If you're like me or the friends that I talk to, this is a complicated relationship for you as well. As with many things that are hard to hold, it's easy to move into one extreme or the other. We can either, kind of on the one hand, completely deny our desires, burying them someplace deep so that we can't be hurt or tempted or disappointed by them. On the other hand, we can fully give in to them, letting ourselves be ruled and guided by them in all areas of life. I've stood in both camps at varying times in my life, at sometimes feeling controlled and almost powerless against my desires. And at other times, which is more often the case for me, completely disconnected from my desires, keeping myself at a safe distance in order to protect myself. Neither of these has ever felt quite right. The author Jen Pollock Michel says, "Desire can race, desire can sputter, but neither is the proper speed." And that really resonates with me. My hope in preparing this lecture is that I might be able to give all of us a framework for how we stand in the tension between those two, because I think that's actually the right place to stand. So my title, after all, is Living with Longing in a Fallen World. So for those of you who like concrete takeaways, my first takeaway point for you right now is that the best way to live with longing in a fallen world is to actually learn to live with it. So we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. I tend to use a great deal of energy trying to keep my desires under wraps. In the world around us, desire is highlighted everywhere, and it can spark desires within us that can seemingly come out of nowhere. I sometimes feel like it's a game of whack-a-mole, this like ever constant vigilance to shut things down as soon as they pop up. In several different places, I've heard the analogy of trying to keep a beach ball under the water, if you've ever tried to do that. Its nature is to be buoyant, and what it wants to do is float right happily on top of the surface of the water. It takes quite a deal of effort to keep it immersed in the water, and the second you take the pressure off, it flies back up and pops back up to the surface, requiring even more effort to wrestle it back down again. I don't know if that sounds familiar to anybody. Just to get this out of the way, there are a couple books I'm going to be referring to heavily this evening. These are the first two. I've already referenced the first author, Jen Pollock Michel. She wrote this book, Teach Us to Want, Longing, Ambition, and the Life of Faith. This was actually, it says 2015 right there. I think it was actually the 2014 Book of the Year, Christianity Today's Book of the Year. And the second one is this book, You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit by James K.A. Smith, or as we like to call him, Jamie Smith, because we're so tight with him around here. Jamie Smith is a philosophy professor at Calvin College in Michigan. So I'm going to be leaning heavily on these two authors in both of these works tonight. I just want to mention two other ones I'm not going to talk about a lot, but just so you know, also from Jamie Smith, Desiring the Kingdom and Imagining the Kingdom. These are two, You Are What You Love, the one I just referenced, just came out, was just published a couple months ago. These books are older. And You Are What You Love is kind of a simplified layman's version of these two books, but it's some really helpful things. So just wanted to put those out there. So the messages about desire are everywhere. Sometimes they're obvious and sometimes they're subtle. We are told what we should desire. We're told what our desires say about us. And we're told about the role that our desires should play in our lives. There's a very close connection between desire, worship, and idolatry. And it often feels like a pretty quick downhill slide from one end of that to the other. The writer David Foster Wallace has a wonderful quote about this. Many of you may have heard this or read this before. This is from a commencement address he did in 2005 at Kenyon College. But I just think he has a really poignant way of speaking about desire and worship. It's helpful. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. And it's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified in myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, epigrams, and parables. The skeleton of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up in front in daily consciousness. Worship power, and you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart. You will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. The insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful. It's that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into, day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. I found, as I said before, Jamie Smith's work very helpful in trying to identify a right understanding of desire. And you are what you love, he says. To be human is to be on a quest. To live is to be embarked on a kind of unconscious journey toward a destination of your dreams. As Blaise Pascal put it in his famous wager, you have to wager. It's not up to you. You are already committed. You can't not bet your life on something. You can't not be headed somewhere. We live leaning forward, bent on arriving at the place we long for. And there are voices all around us, painting pictures for us of this elusive good life that we're all longing for. That's really what David Foster Wallace is getting at too, this unconscious movement towards something that can be, again, sometimes really obvious, very often really insidious and subtle. I want to talk tonight about what I think are three prominent voices that speak to us about desire kind of for the Christian. The first is the wider secular culture, and by secular I just mean specifically outside of the church or current Christian culture. Honestly, if you're a person who lives in the world and like leaves your house ever, then I probably don't need to say much to you about how our modern American culture communicates about desire, because it is everywhere. We live in a time when it seems that everything around us is saturated with longing and desire. If desire, by definition, is something that we want, then this goes hand in hand with the rampant consumerism of our time. The messages about longing and desire are literally everywhere, in advertising, art, media, music, leisure. And they all tell us the same thing. Your desires are everything. You are your desires. To be human is to desire, and that is the primal part of who you are. To quote Jamie Smith again, he says, according to our wider culture, our desires define us. And not only does this wider culture tap into and fan the flame of our desires, but it shapes them as well. As human beings, we share deep longings that are pretty much universal for safety, for love, intimacy, for happiness or flourishing, for attachment, for beauty. And there are others as well. The world of advertising brilliantly taps into our longings and plays on the reality that as human beings, down to the core of our being, we want. It often talks about the heart, the commonly thought of source of these desires. If you pay attention, ads rarely appeal to our brains or our minds. They're always targeted at the heart. And advertisers know this, and they use it as a really powerful force to get us to buy stuff. Just a couple of ads that I came across. These are all from women's magazines, but you can probably imagine the male equivalent. The first is an ad for Clinique, which is a cosmetic company, for a lip gloss, lip scrub combo that says half sugar, half shine, twice as tempting. So even in a subtle way, it's getting at this, like, this idea of temptation and of moving towards temptation. The one on the right, Philosophy, is another cosmetic company. They do mostly skincare products, and they have this product called Hope in a Jar. It's been around forever. And I love that, like, the company is called Philosophy, and the product is called Hope in a Jar. This is for renewed hope in a jar. So, again, it's not that subtle, what it's trying to tell us. On the left, again, here we have the lovely Julia Roberts. This is an ad for a perfume, a Lancome perfume. And you guys probably can't see it, but down here at the very bottom, it says, "Life is beautiful, the fragrance of happiness." Who doesn't want to smell like happiness, you know? And then the one on the right is a jewelry company, I believe. I'm not familiar with this, but the tagline is just, "Live with all your heart." So just, they're just really, you know, getting at it. Recent developments in media and technology have played into our desire to be like God, to have all the knowledge, and to be able to satisfy our whims and cravings immediately. Through technology, we have the ability to put ourselves at the center of the universe in a very tangible way, or perceived center of the universe, obviously. It gives us the sense that we can and should have all the information that we could ever want at our fingertips. And whether that means knowing what's going on the other side of the world, or the ability to get in touch with someone right when we want to, or to know lots of personal details about someone we've never met. Our desire for knowledge, to be connected, to be seen and acknowledged, are all catered to through smartphones and the internet. The internet obviously has also revolutionized the world of pornography in a really significant way, and that's an industry that just plays right into our deep longings for connection, for control, and for sexual fulfillment, but in a way that distorts these desires, which are good, in a harmful way. Much of the art world is driven by the themes of love and longing as well. Many would argue that humans create art in the first place, poetry, music, dance, painting, literature, theater, as a way to express longing and desire and love, as a way that these deep feelings can be better communicated than just through our kind of everyday common speech. Again, a couple examples that I picked up. The painting on the left you probably recognize. That is The Kiss by Gustav Klimt, who's an Austrian painter. It's a really, I mean, it's a beautiful painting, but it's a pretty stereotypical image of kind of what we think of as love or desire. A little bit differently, the one on the right is a still shot of a member of the Alvin Ailey Dance Company out of Harlem. And I think that piece is called Cry, but I just felt like her, kind of everything about that body, her body language there, it's conveying longing and desire in a specific way. I didn't get around to pulling any examples of poetry, but I do want to give a shout out to Sarah, is going to be doing a lecture later in the term, using several poems as a lens to approach the incarnation. So I would encourage you to, I think there'll probably be some overlap there with her. Pop music and romantic comedies also speak right to the heart of our desires for intimacy, belonging, power, companionship, and love. I have a friend who used to refer to romantic comedies as porn for women, mm-hmm. because of the ways that they just get right at the heart of our desire for love, but again, in a distorted way. I grew up in a family that listened to all kinds of music. I didn't grow up in a house that listened to Christian music. I listened to all kinds of music at home and in the car. And I had a distinct memory. I don't know how old I was, 7 or 8 maybe, but I do have a memory of when it dawned on me that almost every single song that I heard on the radio was about love in some way. Love lost, love gained, love gone wrong, love longed for. Ben did a really awesome lecture a couple terms ago on triumphant breakup songs, which is online, I think, if you want to check that one out. It's a good one. I am going to just play an example of a pop song for you now. So it's a little awkward when we do this, but it gives me a chance to stop talking. I'm sure if I gave you a few minutes, all of you could come up with a long list of songs that speak about desire. I mean, you could just go to, like, Taylor Swift's page on iTunes and you'd be good, you know. The song that I've chosen is probably not the most obvious choice, but I think it's one that covers a lot of territory in both content, lyrically, and also style. This is a recent song by Adele. If there's anybody here who doesn't know who Adele is, she is a very, very popular, famous, successful British pop singer with this just amazing, huge voice. She came on the scene about 8 years ago. And she just released her third album this fall, and her albums have gone platinum multiple times over. She's earned a ton of Grammy Awards, Billboard Music Awards, tons. You get the idea. People really love her and respond to her music. I'm going to put the lyrics up so you can follow along, but you're also welcome to just close your eyes and listen. This song is off her most recent album, 25, and it's called When We Were Young.
Everybody loves the things you do, from the way you talk to the way you move. Everybody is watching you, 'cause you feel at home, you're like a dream come true. But if by chance you're here alone, can I have a moment before I go? 'Cause I've been by myself all night long, hoping you're someone I used to love. You look like a movie, you sound like a song. My life reminds me of when we were young. I was so scared to face my fears. Nobody told me that you'd be here. And I swear you moved overseas. That's what you said when you left me. You still look like a movie. You still sound like a song. When we're young, when the sun rises. just like a stone. I'm glad that you remind me when you're young.
First time I heard that song, it was like, just like hit me in the gut. There's a lot here. This just to me, it may not be the same to me. So many pieces of this song kind of speak to this like deep, deep longing. Certainly, some of the themes. She's talking about love lost and longing for it to be revived or realized again. There's this deep longing for youth and for life in the past, history, and I mean a real sentimentality, which is one of my words that came up on my word map at the beginning, but it's a very sentimental song in a way. But I think I can relate to that. I think a lot of us can relate to that, to times gone past. One thing that I think is interesting is that Adele, when her album is called 25, because that's how old she was when she wrote it. I think she's 27 now. But, I mean, she was writing this as a 25-year-old, talking about this, like, I'm so mad I'm getting old. It makes me reckless, you know? But, I mean, that's and there's part of me, I'm like, give me a break. But at the same time, I think it just speaks to our fears of getting older, of loss of beauty, of loss of time. I think even more powerfully that this is being sung, written by someone who's 25 and not someone who's 65. I love that line, you look like a movie, you sound like a song. I mean, this is why art is so powerful, because it draws us in. It gives us a picture of something. And she, in this piece of art that she's created, is speaking of that, too. I think that really resonates. I get it. I get what she's talking about. The images of the movies and the songs that are larger than life, and these pictures that we want to be a part of. I think aside from the lyrics, just her voice, she has this really powerful voice, the melody, the choir that you hear in there. I read an interview with her, or maybe it's an article about her, about when she recorded this album, and presumably her others, they record the songs over and over and over and over and over until she gets that sort of grainy, gravelly place in her voice that communicates. She has such a beautiful voice, but then there's this place of just real grit and friction actually in her voice that she's trying to put into her music, because that communicates something as well. And I think the end of the song, it's this big booming song, and then it ends on this really soft, quiet note. It feels like just sort of giving up to me in a way. So anyway, I just offer that up as one of many, many, many examples of the messages we hear. And I've listened to that song a million times in the car, my iPod, whatever. These things impact us. They're telling us something. They're shaping something. They're giving us so many pictures of this vision of the good life. So aside from that's just a brief little bit about secular culture, I now want to look at the church and how the church has approached desire historically and what that looks like in kind of current church culture. I want to say that I'm going to be drawing with very broad strokes here. I would love in the discussion if we could talk about people's experiences with this. I realize there are probably some churches out there that do a very good job of talking about desire and teaching it. However, I've found that personally, and most people that I've talked to, their experience in the church around teaching and attitudes on desire falls in one of two camps. On the one hand, desire is completely ignored or kind of demonized in a way, and on the other hand, it's kind of minimized and cliched. From the very, very early days of the church, Platonism has had a strong and deep influence within the church. Just the idea originating from the Greek philosopher Plato, that the world is divided into the material realm and the spiritual realm. With the material realm being imperfect, transitory, shadowy, and the spiritual realm being one of ideas and reality and permanence. Under Platonic view, ordinary human experience is meaningless, and the material realm only holds value in so much as it can spark something of the spiritual in us. A 3rd century Roman philosopher, Plotinus, took Plato's ideas further, and this is a quote from him I think is interesting. He wrote that the way to divine knowledge is, quote, to separate yourself from your body and very earnestly to put aside the system of sense with its desires and impulses and every such futility, end quote. So the idea there being that we should put aside all things in the material realm in order to devote ourselves to the spiritual realm, which is where true reality and meaning lie. And this type of thinking and many other threads that have evolved out of it have woven themselves very tightly into the DNA of the church in a way that's actually quite contrary to the teachings of the Bible. I'm not in any way, shape, or form a historian or a philosopher. I know there are many here tonight who could speak to this much more fully than I could. But I think we're still, in the 21st century, we're feeling the impact of Platonic thought in the church. And then other philosophers that have come after him. One example is the 17th century French philosopher René Descartes. He's known for his famous statement, "I think, therefore I am." And he had a lot of influence into this idea that humans are primarily thinking things, that we're primarily oriented and motivated by our minds, our cognition, and our intellect. Jamie Smith uses the idea of a bobblehead doll. I didn't get a picture, but if you know what I'm talking about, those dolls that have small bodies and really big heads, and the heads bounce back and forth, or the idea that human beings are brains on a stick, that our brains and our mind is the most significant part of us. This is a really prominent, deeply held view in our culture at large, and also in the church. And this secular spiritual split has deep roots for all of us, and it's still alive and well. And if this is our lens to viewing humanity and spirituality, then it's no surprise that human longing and desire would fall firmly in the material camp, given how primal and physical and base they are, and how entirely separate from the mind and the higher realms they are. Again, going back to my informal poll of friends and LaBrie students, all of them who had grown up in the church had negative associations with the concepts of desire and longing. And none of them could think of an example of a time that they had been taught well about desire or taught something positive about it. Again, this doesn't mean that there are no churches doing this well, but I think the kind of overwhelming underlying story that people tend to take from the church is that our desires are part of the physical, material, secular world, and that they hold us back, that world holds us back from true spiritual freedom and union with God. One student told me that she had been explicitly taught to turn away from and doubt all of her desires, because as sinful beings, how are we expected to be able to discern which ones are worthy and which ones are not? So it's better to just stay away from them altogether. And another student told me that he had only ever been taught about desire as it pertains to sexual desire. And the message there, of course, was stay away at all costs until you get married and then do whatever you want. And again, another group of Christian men said that they immediately and kind of exclusively thought of desire as pertaining to sexual desire. So it's a really narrow category. And so many of us have been taught this, whether directly or indirectly. And I think we've developed a kind of reaction to desire like Superman and Kryptonite. It's this thing we have to really stay away from because it has the power to destroy us. Our desires have the power to really take us down. It wasn't until I first went to the English Labrie that I remember being taught that explicitly and realized that I also was operating out of a place of a real material spiritual divide. I had this idea that nobody taught me this, but I somehow imbibed this idea that my soul was like this little butterfly or something, caged and trapped by my sinful, broken physical body. Mm-hmm. And not until I died in my physical body that would my soul really be free and really be able to flourish. I mean, that was, I don't think I could have articulated that to you, but kind of a light bulb came on for me. And again, I have no recollection of anyone telling me that or teaching me that, but that's what I had implied. For many of us, this black and white, good, bad way of living can seem easier than trying to tease out what's right and what's wrong in a big pile of gray. It feels safer to lock away our desires than engage in the messy work of sorting out which ones are worthy and which ones are not. Jen Pollock Michelle says this: "This prospect of out-of-control living unhinges us. We prefer the not wanting and the not having to the losing. Like a spigot gushing uncertainty, we turn off desire to prevent it leaking hope. We anesthetize desire, we numb the heart, and this can feel like the safest choice in lives destined for collision with loss." That really hit. I put the book down when I read that. That really hit me. In contrast to the message of the wider culture, which encourages to take hold of and indulge our desires no matter what, the church, whether intentionally or not, has told us to numb, minimize, ignore, stuff down, and even sabotage the longings in our hearts. The underlying impression is that our desires are often too much for God. Either they're too big for Him to handle, or they're too insignificant for Him to be bothered with. It also leads to an extremely fragmented way of living. We run into this so often with our students at Labrie. It's really common for Christians to be leading kind of a double life, with one side marked by a level of faith and desire for holiness and peace, but then another side of life being totally controlled by desires that are running amok and having no idea how to bridge the two. And there's so much shame then that's born out of that kind of two-sided way of living. So that's one way that the church has historically handled the reality of desires and longings, so by kind of ignoring or demonizing it. The other thing I hear from people, and that I've experienced myself, is the way that within the church, desire has been met with cliches or really simple formulas. So, do you have a desire to be married? Don't look for the right person, be the right person. Are you longing for healing from physical illness? Should be grateful for your struggles, because God is using your pain to bless others. Are you longing for a child but unable to have one of your own? That's okay. Now you'll have the freedom to love and serve other people's children more fully. And perhaps the most used and abused response is, unfortunately, from the Bible itself. Psalm 37. "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Delight yourselves in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart." If I had a dollar for every time that had been taught to me, we would have central air conditioning in this house. I mean, it would be a lot of money. It would be a lot of money. And the thing is that none of these statements are untrue. They're not totally untrue. But at best, they're incomplete. And at worst, they're unkind in the face of someone's grief over deep unmet longings. And ultimately, they trivialize those desires as something to brush aside or get over. I'm going to tell you a little personal story about my encounter with this verse. When I was in my early 30s, the worst thing that could happen to a single 30-something happened to me. 5 of my closest friends all got engaged within the same month, and then they all got married within 7 weeks of each other the following summer. While I was genuinely thrilled for all of them, that season left me reeling a bit as well. In addition to navigating those changing friendships, it also highlighted my own desire to be married in vivid technicolor. 4 of those friends were girlfriends, but in one case, I was good friends with the groom. He had moved away a few years prior, and I didn't really know his fiance. When his wedding invitation arrived, I wanted to gag. In addition to an adorable photo of the couple printed right on the front of the invitation. Across the top was, you guessed it, Psalm 37:4. Take delight in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. I don't know for sure how I responded, but knowing myself, I think I like rolled my eyes and like gasped in horror and called a few people who I knew would have gotten an invitation. I was like, can you believe they printed that on their invitation? It was just like these like cute faces staring at me from the invitation, implying that they had clearly taken such delight in the Lord that He had seen fit to give them the desires of their heart, which was to be married to one another. Which, of course, made me feel like I had failed in my own quest to take enough delight in the Lord that He might answer my own prayers for marriage. Or maybe I was overthinking it. Maybe the problem was that I just wasn't cute enough to have my face put on the wedding invitation. I don't know. Of course, my friends weren't trying to send me any secret messages with their wedding invitation, but you get the idea. Several months later, I found myself spending a term at the English Labrie. Near the beginning of the term, one of the workers did an in-house lecture for us on hope. Her takeaway point was this: the only thing in this world that we can put our hope in without fear of disappointment is Jesus. While I certainly agreed with her, it left me wondering, then what are we supposed to do with all of the hopes and desires that we all have that are not guaranteed and do hold a risk of disappointment? The next day, I asked that question at a discussion lunch. The first person to speak up was one of my fellow students, an 18-year-old girl who had been homeschooled all her life and had just left her family in the sunny California coast for the first time. She looked at me and said, "Well, the Bible tells us that if we delight in the Lord, He'll give us the desires of our hearts." Period. And she smiled at me. Sound familiar? As you might imagine, I seriously wanted to throw something at her. I will say she ended up being, as this is often the case with Labrie, one of my favorite people that term, and I'm still in touch with her. She's a lovely person. But again, you get this, and it's like, is that it? Like, surely that can't be the end of the story. That can't be all that the Bible has to say on the topic of desire, yet sometimes in Christian circles it seems that way. For some, Psalm 37:4 has become a Christian prescription for wish fulfillment. The implication is that if we love God enough, He'll give us exactly what we want. If we don't get what we want, then we need to muster up enough love and delight until we like hit some magical threshold. Kind of like a vending machine. If you have the amount of money needed to buy the candy bar that you really want, then good for you. You get what you want right when you want it. But if you're short on money, you either settle for a different, less appealing snack, or you wait until you can hustle up a couple more quarters to get the thing exactly that you want. And the problem, aside from this just being a bad reading of this verse, according to this interpretation, in both cases, our ability to get what we want from God is wholly dependent on us. On us. Some of you can hear this verse with no adverse response, but some of you, I hear, considering, that you probably can't hear this verse without recoiling in some way. I actually thought about using part of this verse in the title of the lecture, and a friend advised me against it. She's like, no, that is way too controversial. Don't put that in the title. So, again, I don't know what your experience has been in the church, but I'd love to just hear more about it in the discussion time. One of the big problems here is that when the church's teaching on desire is incomplete or absent, then a vacuum is created that is quickly filled by the wider secular culture. According to Jamie Smith, we are what we love. So if our options are to either A, ignore what we love, or B, work to please God so that He'll give us what we want, then we'll likely find ourselves being overwhelmed by our desires and looking for any outlet to have them met or to do whatever we can to diminish the pain of not having them met. Back to my word map at the beginning, this is where disappointment, anger, depression, addiction, shame come into the picture around this issue. It's a deep pain of not having our longings met and not knowing what to do with that. But what if there was a third way? So I've talked about the wider culture and the church culture and how they interact with human desire. The secular culture would tell us that we're defined by our desires and that they're what make us human. the line that the church has generally taken is that our desires are not to be trusted because our sinful nature has shaped and tainted them. In certain ways, they're both right, actually. But I think there's a missing piece to each side as well. So I want to turn now to the Bible itself. Does the Bible actually have anything to say about desire, aside from Psalm 34? Does God care about our desires? And the answer overwhelmingly is yes. On one level, you could say that desire is the entire backstory and preamble to the Bible. In fact, both the Old Testament and the New Testament begin with desire. The Bible's commentary on desire starts at the very beginning in Genesis 1. The first three verses of that book say this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. One of the great questions of Christianity is, why did God create humans? Why did the Trinity, being complete in and of itself, go outside of itself to complete man? This is a question that comes up quite a bit at Libri. It's a hard question to answer fully, but if you dig down into it, part of the answer has to be because he wanted to. Humans were born, literally and figuratively, out of God's desire for us. He wanted us, and he wanted this world. Jen Pollock Michelle says this, "Let there be light. God speaks, and the world illuminates, birthing a prince and a planet. He blesses them. These are the words of divine desire, our great creator at his canvas. Every word is a brushstroke. He calls into being the world because he wants to. Desire is the good and beautiful momentum behind the artistry of Genesis 1. Let there be light. No compelling obligation stands behind these words, no shrugging sense of duty, only the heartbeat of heaven and the desire of God for humanity." The Bible is full of God's words and actions, of desire and love and pursuit of his people. In the Old Testament, the creation of Adam and Eve is God's acts of response to desire for himself and for them. The long journey of bringing the Israelites out of slavery and into the promised land is a response of God's deep love for his people and his desire to see them flourishing in the land flowing with milk and honey. From Leviticus 26, "I will look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers, and I will keep my covenant with you. You will still be eating last year's harvest when you will have to move it out to make room for the new. I will put my dwelling place among you, and I will not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt so that you would no longer be slaves to the Egyptians. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to walk with heads held high." The verse that I have highlighted right here, there's something about that verse that always to me, it may not read this way to you, but it sounds like courting language to me. It sounds like romance language to me. I will walk among you, and I will be yours, and you will be mine. Old Testament scholar Sandy Richter describes God's covenants with Abraham, Noah, Moses, and David, as well as the promise of the new covenant to come under Jesus, as part of God's rescue mission for his people. One of my favorite verses of God identifying himself as one who responds to his people's desires comes from Psalm 81. He says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Open wide your mouth, and I will fill it." Just a side note, I popped downstairs to Ben and Nikki's house yesterday, and Dick and Marty were there with the kids, and one of the girls said, "Frances, come look, there's a sort of robin. I had built a nest in the bush right outside their window," and Ellie said, "The eggs have hatched and the mom's feeding the birds." And so I went and looked, and this was the picture. I mean, it was this little bird with its mouth open, like craning its head back and forth, and the mother feeding it. And I just immediately thought of that. It's a beautiful illustration of that verse. Open wide your mouth and I will fill it. Yet how often that is not our idea of who God is. Scriptures describe the God of the Bible as one of abundance and provision. He is a God who listens to the cries of his people, provides for their needs, and meets them in their desires. In Genesis, Abraham's wife Sarah cast out Hagar. who bore Ishmael with Abraham. While she's on the run in a time of dire need, she has an encounter with an angel and names God. You are the one who sees. Scriptures tell us that God sees, hears, cares, and responds to the cries of his people. In Genesis 18, God responds to Abraham's pleading for the saving of the righteous in Sodom and seemingly changes God's mind. In 1 Samuel, God responds to Hannah's pleas for a child, and she gives birth to Samuel, quote, because I asked the Lord for him. Psalm 145, verses 14 to 19, convey it so clearly as well. The Lord upholds all those who fall and lifts up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food at the proper time. You open your hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all his ways and loving toward all he has made. The Lord is near to all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. He fulfills the desires of those who fear him. He hears their cries and saves them. In the New Testament, the arrival of Jesus is the pinnacle of God providing for his people. He gives them something that they didn't even know that they needed, but the one thing that they did desperately need. The disciples longed for a king, though they weren't expecting the one that they got. In the New Testament, we receive the new covenant under Jesus that all might be saved and come to him. A new king who came not to be served, but to serve, as the Gospel of Mark tells us. God gives us the Holy Spirit to guide and intercede and advocate for us until Jesus returns in glory, through whom all will be healed and every tear wiped away when he ushers in his new kingdom. This is a story of love. It's a story of longing and desire, of love lost, and of love found and redeemed. The book of Revelation paints a beautiful picture of Christ seated on his throne in the last days, where every longing and desire is made complete. It's an amazing ending to the story that was born out of desire in the garden at the beginning of the Bible. As I said before, just as the Old Testament begins with a picture of God's desire for his people, so the New Testament begins with desire as well. In the Gospels, Jesus repeatedly asks people, "What do you want?" These are actually the first recorded words of Jesus in the Gospel of John. Sometimes the question takes different forms. It says, "Do you want to get well? Do you believe that I'm able to do this? What is it you want? What do you want me to do for you?" To me, these questions of Jesus are both liberating and terrifying. For those of us who have lived life thinking that our wants and needs are too much, the idea of a God who not only cares, but asks, is huge. But it's also paralyzing. What do we want? Would you have an answer to that question if Jesus asked you that? These moments in the gospel serve as a tangible reminder that not only are our desires not too much for God, he invites the telling and the discovering of them. He wants to hear and receive them. Contrary to the idea that our desires are too much for God, Jesus is very concerned with our desires because he cares about our hearts, what's in our heart and where our hearts are directed, what we want and what we love. And he cares about this because he wants us to love what he loves. 1 John tells us that God is love and that we love because God first loved us. And if we agree that God is a God who is and does love fully and completely, then we, created in his image, are lovers as well. In Desiring the Kingdom, Jamie Smith says, "Human persons are not primarily or for the most part thinkers or even believers. Instead, human persons are fundamentally and primordially lovers." The Bible in no way diminishes the importance or centrality of our rational cognitive minds. But if we can take off our thinking things glasses, then we can more fully see and appreciate the picture in the Bible of humans as lovers. Jamie Smith goes on, "The way we inhabit the world is not primarily as thinkers or even believers, but as more effective embodied creatures who make our way in the world more by feeling our way around it. Like the blind men pictured in Rembrandt's sketches, for the most part, we make our way in the world with hands outstretched and an almost tactile groping with our bodies. One might say that in our everyday, mundane being in the world, we don't lead with our heads, so to speak. We lead with our hearts and our hands." Lately, I've been trying to pray more as a lover to a lover versus a thinking thing to a faraway God. This is really hard for me. In theory, it resonates. In practice, it's really challenging. One thing that was really helpful for me is this past winter, one day, we had a day of prayer and fasting, and Sarah led some of us in a time of breath prayer, which is an ancient form of prayer, which is short and is meant to be prayed multiple times throughout the day in conjunction with our natural rhythm of breathing. The traditional prayer is, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And so when you inhale, you're taking in who God is, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God. And when you exhale, you express out to him what you want. Have mercy on me, a sinner. Sarah led us through a practice of coming up with our own breath prayer based on different names for God and on our own needs. I immediately connected with one of my favorite names for God, Jehovah Jireh, provider. But then I got stuck. What did I want from God? I was sitting in my chair quite still, but internally I was stumbling around. But then it came out. Jehovah Jireh, provider God, fill my groping hands. That image just struck me as just a reality of where I sit so often in front of God and just in the world. In his essay, The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis says this, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drinks and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. This breath prayer and this idea of a lover-to-lover prayer is helping me be a little more brave in this way that Lewis articulates beautifully, of just trying to be honest with myself in the ways that I am far too easily pleased, and trying to imagine something other, this infinite joy that God has offered us. Jamie Smith argues that the end goal, the place that we're leaning towards, is one that is not primarily negotiated by our thoughts and our beliefs, but our desires. He says it's less an ideal that we have ideas about and more a vision of the good life that we desire. So I would ask you, what is your vision of the good life? For some of us, this may be a vision that we can articulate in clearly defined ways. But for most of us, it's a more general, visceral picture of what we long for our lives and world to be that hovers somewhere right under the surface. Smith describes these visions of the good life as kingdoms, our personal picture of peace, or shalom, as the Bible calls it. That to be human is, quote, to desire the kingdom, some kingdom. Smith points out that these kingdoms are not only a personal, private form of Eden, but also a social vision of what life should look like, too. It's a vision of what the world ultimately should be, some vision of human flourishing. And should is a powerful word. Most of us, regardless of our background or religious beliefs, can come up with a picture of what life should or shouldn't be. We might not be able to articulate it when asked, but we know it when we see it. That job should have been mine. I should have been married by this point in my life. A child shouldn't have to suffer through something like that. It shouldn't be this way. Sometimes we don't realize what our vision of the kingdom is until something goes awry on the journey getting there. People who work with grief, counselors and work with people going through grief, often say that when a relationship is broken, whether that's through death or disability or breakup or divorce, that it's not only the person and the relationship that should be grieved, but also the vision of the life that you thought you would have with that person. Some people are quite sensitive to their own vision of the kingdom, but many of us have grown cynical around that concept. Because if you live long enough, you learn the hard way that for 99.9% of us, our path toward our vision of the kingdom will not go like we expect it to. Because of the disappointments, it can actually become a really frightening and vulnerable thing to admit to ourselves or to others what it is we really want, to lay our longings bare and to give them a name and a form. As with many things in life, children can sometimes be our best guide through this world of kingdom journeys. Most children, yet unmarked by the strains, disappointments, and loss that come along in life, are able, sometimes with uncanny clarity, to articulate their vision of a good life. I want to give you two examples. The first one is a hard one. The first one comes from the website Humans of New York. I don't know if any of you are aware of this blog. This is a blog that started by a photographer named Brandon Stanton, who lives in New York. And he just started taking pictures of random people on the streets of New York, posting them on his blog, and then writing a short quote from them. I follow him on Instagram, and he recently did a series at the pediatric cancer wing at Memorial Sloan Kettering Medical Center in Manhattan. Some of you may have seen that, followed along. It was just a gut-wrenching, yet really beautiful series on kids, parents, doctors, nurses who live in that world. Because I was preparing this lecture, one post particularly caught my attention. I don't know this little girl's name, or how old she is. She's a teenager, but I won't read the whole thing, but she was diagnosed with a very severe form of cancer, and she was told that she had that they could guarantee her 3 years to live. And she says, "My biggest worry is that I'm going to die and not do all the things I wanted to do. The funny thing is, I didn't even realize how many things I wanted to do until I got diagnosed. Simple things like meeting a guy, getting married, getting a job, having my own apartment, and picking out my own furniture. Those never seemed too interesting to me. They just seemed like adult things that were guaranteed to happen. Now I want to do them so bad because I want to know what they feel like." This is a perfect example of our vision for the kingdom being cut off at the pass. The second example is a bit more lighthearted. It's from my 4-year-old friend, Finley. It's a piece of work. I have his mom's permission to share this. Finley has a younger brother. So Finley is 4, or he was 4 at the time that this events happened, and he has a younger brother and sister who are 2-year-old twins. His mom's a good friend of mine, and a few months ago, I was watching all the kids for her one afternoon because she was stuck without a sitter, and we'd been out for a while. I went and picked Finley up at school, we ran errands, we were in the car a lot, and it was a beautiful day, and we'd been talking the whole time about when we got home, the kids could play outside in the backyard. So when we got out of the car, all three just ran directly into the backyard to play. And within about 60 seconds, I heard all this screaming and yelling and cacophony. And I turned around to find Finley wrestling all the toys, or all these, you know, cars and trucks and things in the backyard, wrestling all the toys away from the twins, like prying them out of their hands. And both the twins just, like, reduced to tears in the grass. When I went to intervene to find out what was going on, Finley very calmly gave me a rational explanation of what he was doing. You see, he had to take the toys away from the babies because he knows how to play with them best. He was going to put them on top of the play structure where he was going to make a garage for all the cars and trucks to get washed, check the engine, etc. And this, of course, had to happen out of the reach of the twins. So when I gave him the requisite speech about sharing, taking turns with the toys, the twins got to them first, they get the first turn, he completely lost it. Like, I've never seen him lose it before. So I gave the toys back to the twins and just removed him from the scene. And he went nuts. And he was shouting and crying, "But you're ruining my plan. I need the toys for my plan. The babies are messing it all up. You're not the boss of me." This is my favorite. "I'm the boss. I'm the boss of everything. I'm the boss of the babies. I'm the boss of the play structure. I'm the boss of the whole backyard. I'm the boss of all the toys in the backyard. And you have to let me go and do what I want to do now." It was like this very, like, impassioned thing. And I was totally annoyed and kind of stunned. But part of me felt really sympathetic towards him. I was like, "Yeah, I get that. I get that, kid. I get it." So I would urge you, after you leave tonight, to spend some time thinking about what your picture of the good life is. What is the kingdom that you are leaning toward? What is the vision that's captured your heart and is pulling you forward by the force of its power? I tried to lay out a few of the voices that speak to us about our desires, hopefully pointing out the missing pieces in the view from the wider culture and also from the traditional church culture. But the thing is, as I said before, neither of them is completely wrong. I would argue that to a certain extent, secular culture gets it right, and that we are, in some point, defined by our desires, that to be human is to desire. And the traditional church culture gets it right in its message that our desires are not all right. Because of our sinful nature, we cannot fully trust that our desires are pointing us in the right direction. Jamie Smith talks about our hearts being a combination of a compass and a homing device. It's the instrument that guides us, locked in on the vision of the kingdom that we have put before us. But it's an instrument, like any compass, that consistently requires recalibration. The work of Christ was and is to help us correctly see the direction of our broken hearts, that our broken hearts are pointed in, and to turn them back to the right path, to recalibrate them to his kingdom and to his vision of human flourishing, not our own, as we live in the now and the not yet tension of God's kingdom being fully realized on earth. Jen Pollock Michelle says this: we chronically want wrong things. That's so true. That feels so true for me. Hence, we're in a constant danger of our idolatry, turning good things into our whole picture of the kingdom. Again, in The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis says this: the books are the music, or you could substitute person or possession or institution, in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them, it only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshippers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. What we need to live with the deep longings of our hearts and to truly flourish as human beings are ways to keep our hearts aligned to God's kingdom, to his version of human flourishing, to keep the recalibration going. I would call these things practices. Jamie Smith would call them liturgies or habits. He says that liturgies are practices and rituals that effectively and viscerally train our desires. Depending on our histories, we have different reactions to the word liturgy. But knowledge only gets us so far, because we have to step out of the world of ideas and thinking things in order to redirect our hearts. We have been made physical beings. Embodiment is what it means to be made human. We need to reshape the way we exist in the world so that we can stay directed towards God's kingdom, towards his view of the good life for us. So I'm going to just kind of to end here. I'm going to offer up a few ideas, a few guides and practices that I've found helpful, that other people have found helpful, a few habits that would ideally help us ground and shape our desires. Because I said this before, none of our habits are neutral. And I would love to hear more ideas from you. Jamie Smith calls all of this worship. These habits, these practices, these liturgies are all worship. The first one is to practice honesty. This is a very simple truth that I've found to be immensely freeing. That when it comes to desire, I often find myself bound up in fear that makes speaking the truth to myself or to God incredibly difficult. Jen Pollock Michelle talks about this here. She says, how do we ever decide that our desires are anything other than the sin-sick expression of our inner corruption? Can we trust our desires if we ourselves can be so untrustworthy? These are important questions. These are critical hesitations, and desire, if it is to be made holy, must remain committed to truth. Jesus insisted that truth is a path to freedom. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Truth-telling, in fact, is a way we begin in the gospel, and it is the gospel that frees our desires from fear. And I think there's three things we can do to help us in our truth-telling. The first is, sorry, those are probably kind of hard to see. As best you can, name your desires. Identify your vision of the kingdom. Write them down, speak them aloud, pray them out. As we know from Genesis, naming has power. It's a way we exhibit our God-given dominion, and it helps free us from delusion and from living in unreality. The second way of practicing honesty is to grieve. I haven't talked much tonight about what to do when God doesn't give you the desires of your heart. But all of us sooner or later will be faced with the disappointment, and in some cases really crippling grief that comes when our desires elude us and when our picture of the kingdom is taken away. When God seemingly doesn't answer prayer for healing, for a child, for a spouse, for the life we hope for, we are all walking around with broken hearts. But Isaiah tells us that Christ came to bind up the brokenhearted, and that Jesus was well acquainted with sorrow, so we know that he can carry our grief with us. And then the third form of truth-telling is to practice gratitude. I always feel like I run the risk of sounding like Oprah when I say this, but practicing thankfulness is a very critical step in truth-telling, to cultivate eyes and a heart to recognize the really just massive gifts and blessings and provisions that God has given to us, some that we've asked for, some that we have not articulated, but he's given to us anyway. It's really critical for helping to keep ourselves in alignment with his kingdom and his provision for us. The second category is, for lack of a better term, corporate worship. And what I mean by that is just things that we do together as a community, as relational beings. God's created us relational beings. As his people, we are one body. And to work well and be whole, we have to bind our lives together. This idea of one body is a really powerful image and one we need to hold on to. A couple years ago, I did a kind of an intense study on the book of Leviticus with a group of people from my church, and I was so struck by the fact that you read this book and you think, like, how in the world do these people live by this crazy set of rules, the sacrificial system, lifestyle rules, food rules, but they did it together. They did it as a community, and that's a huge, huge piece. They carried each other, and so together their daily life, the rhythms of their daily life were reminders for all of them, as individuals and collectively, of their orientation and their call from God. So a couple ways to do this. One is church attendance. I am not going to get into the topic of church membership and attendance here. That's something other people have talked about. But our presence and participation in Sunday church services does a ton to shape our vision of God's kingdom. The call to worship at the beginning of a service is a reminder to us that this is not our work, that God spoke first, and that he's called us to him and to his kingdom. At church, we stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder with one another, facing God, theoretically, as opposed to everyday life where we're generally oriented towards ourselves or towards another person. At church, we exist in this space to share this orientation towards God, which is, again, a very tangible picture of the life that we'll have together in heaven. Same thing with communion, which I'll get to in a minute. Again, at the end of the service, when we prepare to leave, typically a benediction is prayed over that for over us. A benediction is usually a word of blessing, but also a charge to take that blessing out to the world. God's blessing is not just for us personally to hold. It's for us to take and to take out into the world and be a blessing. And those are things that we go through those motions, and I think those of us who've been in the church for a long time don't even think of those things, but they're really powerful habits that shape our view of who God is. The second is confession. Confession is something that we can practice together at church or individually. Confession really has a presence in kind of Catholic and other liturgical high churches. It gets a little less play in some evangelical Protestant churches, but it's a command. It's something that Jesus tells us to do together. And it's a powerful thing to confess and look at the dark parts of our lives. It helps us realize that our heart compasses are not in alignment. It's a way of putting them back in alignment. My church does not use the Book of Common Prayer, but there's this awesome line in one of the corporate prayers of confession there that says, "Forgive us for the things we have done and the things we have left undone." That's so powerful for me individually, but also as a church for us to do that together. Third one is communion. Again, at the communion table, we're catching a glimpse of heaven as we practice the meal together, that we will eat together in the presence of God and one another. Again, we're following a command. Jesus said, "Do this in remembrance of me." He didn't just say, "Remember." He didn't say, "Think about this." He said, do this. This is a very embodied thing that we're doing to live in his kingdom as he's designed it for us. The last one is eating together. This is something that can happen with a church community or outside. We do this a lot at La Brie. We eat a lot together. But sharing meals together, again, is just a tangible reminder of the goodness of God's creation, of the bounty of his provision, of the sacredness of the table, the beauty of community, all things that orient us towards the goodness of God's kingdom. And then the last kind of group of things is just to cultivate daily practices for yourself. The first is prayer. This obviously goes into the church category and the worship category and the relational category. But I would encourage you to think, pay attention to what your sort of daily habits are that move you through the day. Deliberate times of personal prayer are really critical for a right orientation towards God's kingdom. There's a million things in our lives every day to distract us in a million different directions, and we need to read God's word and to be in prayer to be directed towards him. This is part of the truth-telling that I spoke of earlier. We have students who come to La Brie all the time who consider themselves Christians, but they say they have no experience of God. But they spend little to no time in the Bible or prayer. And those two things have to go together. This is where God meets us. The Lord's Prayer is extremely helpful here. I think the beginning of it, especially, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." We're right at the beginning of that prayer. This is what we're praying. Align me with your vision for your kingdom, that your kingdom would come to earth. So that's the kingdom that I'm pointed towards. Right after that is "Give us this day our daily bread." And New Testament scholar N.T. Wright points out that that is the right ordering of things, that we recognize and we ask for God's kingdom to come into our lives and into our worlds before we offer up our specific needs and our specific desires. The second one is just rhythms of the day or the season. Again, how do you begin your day? Do you begin your day in prayer or around the table, in fellowship with your family, or is your first act in the morning to pick up your smartphone and check your texts or your emails, your social media accounts? I can definitely raise my hand here and say that that's a struggle for me, or to end my day that way, for that to be the last thing I look at when I end my day. And it's not good. The times that I've managed to break that habit, I've just felt a very noticeable difference in kind of my mindset and my orientation. But again, just all these little things in our days that we think don't matter, the type of music that plays in the background of your life, the type of physical space you inhabit, the food that's on your table, do you spend most of your day inside or most of your day outside? These are things that are not neutral. They point us to something. So I would encourage you to think about what they're pointing you to. The Chestnuts have, those of you who've been to their apartment, have a kind of a banner that hangs on the wall right when you walk into their apartment that has fabric hanging on it that marks the different seasons of the church calendar. Again, whether your church is one that follows the liturgical calendar or not, getting some kind of something to help you follow the church calendar is really a helpful just visual reminder that we are walking together through this calendar that God's given us. One thing that was really significant to me, I have a friend who is single, and for the past like 5 or 6 years, she has kind of committed in the month of December to praying every day for marriage for herself and for like a list of single friends by name. And about 2 years ago, I was like, I'm going to join you in this. I'm going to do this too. And the first couple days, and I love Advent. I love the season of Advent and Christmas. And the first couple days, I was like, it just feels weird. Something just felt weird about praying for marriage during Advent. Like there seemed to be this disconnect. Like the focus was off. And then a couple days in, I was like, oh. Because what is Advent? We are marking the first coming of Jesus, and we are also making this very tangible mark in our life that we are waiting for him to return again. We are waiting for the bridegroom. We are waiting for that. That's the wedding we're moving towards, not the one that happens in the church down the road. That's the wedding that we're moving towards. And I don't know that she particularly designed it that way, but it's become a really profound practice for me to pray for marriage, for physical marriage, during the month of December and the seasons of Advent, because it's framed in this beautiful way that, like, that's ultimately not the goal. We can pray for those things because those are the desires of our heart and God cares about that. But ultimately what we're waiting for is the wedding of the bridegroom to come. And that's just been a helpful thing for me. And the last part is just relationships. You can't do this by yourself. We need people in our lives to walk with us together. My pastor once said that in this day and age, you can do almost anything alone. You can even have a baby alone. But there's two things you can't do alone. You can't be married alone, and you can't be a Christian alone. And in my experience, this is so true. Just as it's not wise or a safe idea to hike alone, we need traveling partners on this journey towards the kingdom. We need people to redirect our steps on the path when we can't do it for us, to support us when we're tired, to offer to share their food with us, to help us recalibrate our compass when it goes off the mark. We really need other people. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here. I've presented a lot more than I wanted to, but my hope is that in all of this you can find something to hold on to for your journey to figure out what it means to live with longing. I want to leave you with two final images. One's a visual image and one is a quote. The first is a painting by a French painter named Eugène Bernan. This was brought to my attention last term by one of our students, Ingrid. The painting actually has several titles, but it's called Peter and John Running Towards the Grave. And I think it's a beautiful image of what it means to lean forward. When Jamie Smith talks about us leaning forward and navigating the world with our bodies and our groping hands, that this is such a beautiful picture that I think for this, opposed to what Adele is giving us, this vision of this picture of leaning forward towards the risen Christ and his kingdom to come. And the quote at the bottom is from Augustine. When he is revealed, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. So now is the time for groaning, then it will be time for rejoicing. Now for desiring, then for embracing. What we desire now is not present, but let us not falter in desire. Let long, continuous desire be our daily exercise, because the one who made the promise doesn't cheat us. So I'm going to stop there. It is hot in here. Thank you for paying attention for longer than I have meant for you. Yeah, so for those of you who've never been here before, our practice at LaGrie is just to open it up for questions and discussion. People can throw things out. I've said this a couple times. I would love to hear your thoughts on this topic and ways that you've lived with this. If you need to go, feel free to go. Nobody has to stay till the bitter end. So feel free to take off if you need to. But otherwise, we'll open it up to comments, questions, complaints, all the above. Priya.
You and I have talked about the prayer of examine, and so I'm just curious if that prayer falls under these daily practices, like, and is helpful in this way.
Yeah, absolutely. For those of you who don't know, the prayer of examine is a very old form of prayer, which is traditionally prayed at the end of the day. And the idea is to just sort of think through your day. It's a way to reflect on your day. And to ask a set of opposing questions. There's a couple different ways to frame the questions. The typical one is to say, what was I most thankful for today? What was I least thankful for today? It could also be, where did I most experience love? Where did I least experience love? Where do I feel like I met God? Where do I feel like God was absent? So there's a number of different ways to get at it. But it's a way to be reflective on what has been in our day and then to take that and to offer it back to God in prayer. So the things that we are thankful for, the places where we are able to recognize gift and love and presence, to give thanks to him for that, and in the places where we felt we were left or we were stranded, things were difficult, whatever, to lay that at the foot of the cross as well. And so it's this idea that God wants to hear both of those things. He wants to hear our thanksgivings, but he wants to hear the difficult things as well. So, yeah, I found that very helpful practice. Yeah. If anybody else has any great formulas or answers for any of this, feel free.
Just at the end of it, the last thing for you. I couldn't remember exactly, but something about something about our desires and not fear.
And not fear?
Well, I think that was,
they not falter?
Was it?
Desires not falter.
Say that again?
You said don't fear your desires.
Yeah. Was it something up here or just something
yes.
that I said?
Yes, it was something. Well, both, but it was something here. Well, maybe just before that.
That last line. The last quote.
Oh, right here.
Oh, yes.
Truth telling, in fact, is the way we...
The gospel frees our desire for fear.
Yep. Are you wondering about that connection between desire and fear?
Well, yes, I guess so. Yeah. The gospel frees our desires from fear. These are desires from fear, so. And so what does that mean, our desires, these are desires from fear?
I think...
We might fear that our desires are wrong.
Yeah, I think that many people, that there is actually a strong connection between fear and desire. So it can be what you just said, that our fears are wrong. We can.
Our fears are wrong. No, you mean our desires.
Our desires are wrong. Sorry. Yeah, our desires are wrong. I think there's a deep fear in expressing our desire, and then being fearful that they won't be met. Mm-hmm. So then, what do we do if our desires aren't met? And so, a fear that speaking it out loud puts it out there, and then the reality of it not being met is a fearful thing.
When we speak it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think the idea is that because of the gospel, we don't have to be afraid of our desires, and we don't have to be afraid for our desires because the gospel message is that Jesus has come to not grant our wishes like a genie in a bottle, and not to make our lives look perfect or to make our lives look exactly like we want them to, but he has promised to come and to meet our needs. And to bring us into his kingdom, and that's something to have a great sense of peace about. So in that sense, the gospel is an antidote to fear when it comes to desire.
I'm sorry, it's an antidote to fear.
As fear is related to desire. Yeah.
Delight yourself in the Lord, and you shall bring your desire to your heart. If we delight ourselves in the Lord, then the desires of our heart should be something he likes himself.
Absolutely, yeah.
If we delight ourselves in the Lord.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
that seems to be the biggest thing, to do delight ourselves in the Lord, and then the rest will take care of itself. If we really delight ourselves in the Lord. I don't always do that.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I know you. I talked about that at the beginning. You might have missed that part at the beginning because I talked about that. Because what Psalm 37 is, if you read the whole thing in context, yeah, it's all about the Lord. It's all about our praise of Him, our life in Him. I take great comfort in that verse because it's implying that God can, our desires aren't fixed. They're not static. God can shape them. God can change them. God can morph our hearts and morph our desires, which is an amazing comfort. That does not mean that we then, no matter how much we focus on God and delight ourselves in the Lord, there will still be things in our lives that our heart moves towards that are not realized. We will still have those disappointments. So it's not a perfect formula, but I think there's a lot of hope in that. That it goes back to this idea of orienting. What kingdom are we oriented towards? And if we're oriented towards the kingdom of God, then there's room for our desires in there, and there's room for God to move and to work in our hearts and transform those things.
So I love this thing, topic. You're hitting a lot of deep things. There's something that happens in the life of Christ that I think connects a lot of this together, and kind of amazing way, particularly in that Jesus' own desires were expressed, take this cup away from me, and there was a no there, so Jesus experienced the disappointment of his desire to not die.
Absolutely.
And but at the same time, we're told that there was joy set before him, so you have this combination of rejected desire with future joy. And so out of those lessons in life, I kind of backed into this one through the experience of disappointment and desire. Shared a little bit about this at lunch, but I was planning a church for about 2 years, and it was a dream, is what I hoped to do. Everything was coming true until it died. And it's like, okay, what do you do with that death? You know, slow motion death, especially when you see it coming, you fight it, you don't want it to happen, but it happens anyway.
Yeah.
Now, where was God in the midst of that? And just one of the few churches that Satan was allowed to have his way with this one. He knows the gates of hell will not prevail against it, but it sure seems to be prevailing here. So it really forced me out of desperation, really, back into how is God at work, and loss, failure, death, shame, rejection, disappointment. Are those moments that God is absent, or moments that we just are supposed to sweep under the rug and forget, put on a happy face, and all kinds of different ways to approach that.
Yeah.
And the thing that really brought me out of a pretty dark place that I shared a little bit during lunch as well is 2 Corinthians 4:10. Paul's talking about his life, really, and he's talking about this dynamic of being persecuted, but not destroyed, struck down, but not abandoned, hard pressed on every side, but not crushed. He's talking about physical things. He says, we're also perplexed, but not in despair. So now he's talking about emotional things. And he sums it all up by saying, we always carry around in our body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our body. So what Paul just did, describing all of us, is he said the same dynamic that was present in the garden is always present in us as well. So in each, he's reinterpreting his whole life through the lens of rhythmically carrying Jesus' death and resurrection in his body. That can sound morbid until you realize that resurrection was inevitable for Jesus, and therefore it's inevitable for us, and that death is the gateway drug to resurrection. So we're invited to imbibe death because of the inevitable end game. So there's a causal word. So we always carry his death in our bodies. So when you lose a child, when you lose a job, when you go bankrupt, when your church dies, when your dream dies, when your relationship dies, those aren't freaks of nature or things to be swept under the rug. They're actually opportunities in a mysterious way to carry Jesus' death in our body. That's what Paul says, right? I was struck down, persecuted, and that was all me carrying Jesus' death in my body. And so it's morbid if that's an end in itself, which it isn't. God is not a sadistic God. And so I think the real focus of desire for me has shifted to resurrection, not just future resurrection, because Paul says we always carry his death so that we can also always carry his life in our body. So what does it mean to have the inevitability of resurrection always at work in my body, in every life decision, situation, emotion, that things in me need to die and things in me need to be brought to life, and it's the Holy Spirit that's at work living that out in me. So I would finish by saying, for me, the desire is now closely connected to imagining and living out resurrection life. And so you see it in the parable of the prodigal son. This son of mine was dead, but now he's alive. So he got to taste the resurrection of his son in his life. Abraham received Isaac back from the dead, and so he tasted resurrection in this life. So this idea that resurrection of Christ breaks into this life and starts pulsating through the veins of Christians who carry Jesus' death and therefore his life in their body. And so the quote that I just wrote a book about this, or a manuscript anyway, but the quote that probably captures this the most is, we fear death because we believe no better life exists than the one we've created for ourselves. So we don't believe in resurrection to the extent that there's fear that captures us. we believe in resurrection to the extent that we're fearless, because fear is all fear is fear of death. That's all fear boils down at the end of the day. If you ask what I'm afraid of, in some form you're afraid of death. Death of a dream, death of a relationship, death of a person, death of control, whatever. And so once resurrection becomes inevitable for you through Christ, and this is all a process, and this isn't easy, and there's lots of grieving. I love that you talk about grieving and process. But once resurrection becomes inevitable, it's a complete change of mindset. Instead of wondering what my death's going to look like, I now wonder what my resurrection's going to look like. So having experienced death on multiple levels in multiple ways, every time I see death, I now start thinking, this is going to be a really interesting resurrection story. Because resurrection is now what breaks into life for me. Not death is just, again, it's, death is now the servant of resurrection. It's all death is. Disappointment, failure, fear, it's all in service of resurrection for the Christian. So it completely turns on its head what we fear, and what we fear actually becomes what we expect in the service of resurrection. And I don't fear, I don't expect death all the time. I simply receive it when it comes. Because Jesus wasn't morbid, and the people that came to him weren't morbid. They wanted their kids to live and not die.
Yeah.
So we hunger for life. But when death comes, we don't fear it, because we know even death gets turned into life.
We hunger for life, but when death comes, we don't fear it.
Do you have any advice for people who have a very hard time with letter A? Because my experience is that when I was a kid, my desires were suppressed by my upbringing. And I wasn't allowed to express them because it would open me to tremendous amount of persecution. I won't get into any details, but it meant that I wasn't in touch with what I really wanted. And that's what fucked people about me. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know who I was supposed to be alive to. I didn't know what my ambitions were. I didn't want anything, because I couldn't allow myself to, because it would cause me a tremendous amount of pain. Do you have any advice for getting in touch with the good desires in your heart?
Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
I'm sure everyone has experienced it at some level. And I'm sure there's people who have experienced a problem with their name. Living under, say, slavery, that would cause the same sort of death.
Sure. Yeah.
Fair. Well, you think, I wanted to say, I think your comment about where do we hear ourselves saying, oh, it should have been like X, Y, Z, I think that's actually a tremendous step toward getting in touch with the way, the vision that we have for our desires, I guess. The vision we have for our kingdom, I think. Even being able to say, I should have been free to express my longing as a child. I should have been free to dream. Is a step toward, well, that's the best desire, to have had that, and then to be free for that. So, I don't know. I think that I haven't thought of it before. Like when I say shoulds, or it should be like this, or it should be like that. Oh, that's a clue for me that whether it's for good or for ill or something in between, that's revealing my longings.
Just a personal example of that. When I was, I guess I was in maybe my early 30s or just turned 30 or something, and I had about, it was around the time that I spoke of like all the friends getting married. It was sort of that season of life. And I had like a 6-month period where I was just sort of in a funk, and I was like, am I depressed? I have, depression runs in my family quite regularly, and I'm like, is this depression? Like, what is this? I just was like, people were like, what's wrong? I'm like, I don't know. I'm just kind of, and I don't know what the sort of, what made the light bulb come on, but I just had this, a day where I was like, I am really disappointed. I'm just really disappointed. And it took a little while, but I was able to articulate. And 2 days beforehand, there's no way I could have articulated this to you. But I realized, I grew up in the South. And I realized that, and I was never somebody who had a plan for my life. I wasn't like, I'm going to be married by the time I'm 25, and I'm going to have 2.3 kids. And, like, that just wasn't me. I just was sort of like feeling, this is why this resonates with me. I just sort of feel my way through life. I'm not much of a kind of a long-term planner. And I realized that I actually had a very strong picture of what my life was going to look like. And then all of a sudden at 31 or however old I was, I just sort of like woke up and took a step back and I was like, it never dawned on me that by the time I was in my early 30s, I wouldn't be married with nobody on the horizon. I wouldn't have children with none on the horizon. And I was also in a hard place professionally. I had kind of left one career to step into another one, and it just wasn't going well. And I was like, and I never would have guessed that I would have, by 31, kind of burned through two careers and be like, what am I? And I was like, what am I supposed to be doing with my days? Like, there's no spouse, there's no children, there's no career. What am I supposed to wake up and do every day? And I think there was just something, and I wish I could tell you exactly what it was, but there's no, like, I would have never, 2 weeks before, I wouldn't, there's no way I would have said, oh, yeah, I expected, my plan, my vision was that by the time I was 31 or however old I was, these things would have fallen into place. Like, I wasn't aware of it enough to articulate it. But then when, I think it was just this sort of perfect storm of, like, all these friends getting married and my community shifting, my career, my job sort of falling apart a little bit. It was just sort of all at the same time. Like, nothing seemed to be working or going well. And it made me realize, like, oh, I actually had a really strong expectations and a really strong vision, a kingdom, if you will, that I was moving towards. And it took sort of that perfect storm of things for me to sort of see it in that way and to realize that there was just, it was a lot of disappointment and grief. It took a while to name it, to be able to name that around, not a specific thing. No person had broken up with me. I didn't get fired. I didn't, you know, but it was just this sort of general grief that, like, my life is not as I thought it would be. And so in that case, I mean, that ties in with what Sarah said a little bit. It wasn't, I think it took these circumstances in my life and of me being like, it shouldn't be like this. This isn't how it was supposed to go down. So I think to pay attention to those things in your life, sometimes we don't know them until we see them. We don't know them until we come up against them. I was talking with Joe this morning about just talking about death a little bit, what you were talking about, and we can talk about, from a Christian perspective, we can talk about death and not having to fear death and the promise of resurrection. And I've had 4 deaths in my family in the past 4 years, and the Morrell's dog died this week, and Joe and I were talking about that this morning, and he was just saying, like, you know, it's just like, he's like, it's just a dog, it's just a family dog, but still there's something, like, that's, you know, wrong about that. And I remember a couple years ago, one of my grandmothers passed away. She was almost 98. She had this good long life. She wasn't sick, she wasn't in pain. She sort of died in a way we might all hope that we would. And I was just so struck when she died. I was like, this is so wrong. This is so wrong. Death is so offensive. And it's sort of easy to be like, yeah, death is offensive. I'm so glad, you know, but there really is something about it actually happening and sitting in a graveside, and this, from dust you shall come, into dust you will return, and the dirt is right in front of you, that just, again, it's this, it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't be this way. And so I think, yeah, paying attention to those places, in your life. I think paying attention to the shifts, I think one is paying attention, if you can, to your daydreams. You know, where does your mind wander when the time and the space is there? What are the things that occupy your thoughts when they don't have to be on some particular thing, you know? That's something that, for me too, has been kind of in the case. I don't know if it's helpful. Jeff?
I love that C.S. Lewis quote that you showed about our desires are not too strong, they're too weak.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen that several times.
I know, I think Ben read that to you guys earlier. I'm like,
it's a great quote. Yeah.
You guys are getting it on repeat.
And it just got me thinking about all the different images or kind of like layers of longing that we find in the Bible. Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to make a quick list. You already talked about the marriage, longing for this person, this relationship with Jesus, longing for place, a homeland in Hebrews. Like, it makes sense they were seeking a homeland. Longing for a new body, that Elijah was kind of talking about that. Longing for a new temple, longing for a new earth. And it strikes me that if I'm someone who's really shaped by the Bible, I'm someone who has, like, a really rich, multifaceted kind of longing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like a diminished one, but it's really an expanded one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just struck by all those different metaphors and images of longing.
Absolutely.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And it's interesting because a couple years ago, I was in a small group Bible study with a group of girls who I've known forever. They've been Christians for a long time. They're really wonderful, mindful people. And something came up. I'm the only single person, and I'm the only person without children in the study. Everybody else is married with kids. And I don't even know what we were saying, but something came up about longing or desire or something. And somebody was like, I don't really struggle with that. And somebody else was like, yeah, me neither. I can't really think of an example of when I've, like, really longed for something that hasn't happened. And I was like, what? Like, who are you? And it was surprising because I'm like, I know these people. They're deep, thoughtful, contemplative people. And so I hear people say that sometimes. I'm like, what planet do you, like, I want to come live on the planet you live on. I don't, you know, but you're right. I mean, it really is everywhere. And I think for me, I won't go into the story, but part of what, I didn't really grow up in a Christian home, but I grew up in the church. But one of the sort of, like, turning points for me of sort of making a deliberate step towards Christ was this deep longing for home. And I had a great home. I mean, I have awesome parents, and I'm very thankful for the home I came from. So it's not like this is something that was absent in my life and I was trying to find that. But still, as somebody who came from a really solid, loving, warm, accepting home, I still have this really deep desire, longing for home. And that was part of what kind of propelled me kind of towards Christ in a more deliberate way. So it is. And I think it's like that little short list. Like, to me, that's, again, it's a comforting thing. I mean, this idea that, like, our desires are too much for God or that He doesn't care, you know, they are. They're everywhere in the world. They're everywhere in the Bible. And so I think, like, it just makes this so spot on, you know?
Yeah. And like, this quote just sort of connects to Adele's song, a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, longing for a love that looks like a movie, you know, a love that looks like a song. Like, I think that the difference between Adele and C.S. Lewis is Jesus. Like, that is, like, very simple.
A few other things.
Yeah. Right, yeah. But I just think, like, there's nothing that, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is everyone has that opportunity to come to understand the fullness and the depth of desire and to really be able to articulate it on our journey. Like, and I think that, I mean, we can pray for Adele that she will, you know, like, her desires will get bigger, you know, for beyond wanting a love that looks like a movie.
Yeah.
And I think what we get to long for is, like, what is an Isaiah 61, you know, about, like, we get to long for beauty for ashes.
Yeah.
We get to long for redemption, for captives to be set free, for the blind eyes to be opened, for lame to walk, you know. And I think that is where, like, the more that we press into the things that you said, community, relationship, the word, and just Jesus, like, the person of Jesus, it is just going to expand those. And we can still say, oh, I long for my husband, or I long for my husband,
absolutely.
Or I long, you know, for all of them. But I just think that the idea that you talked about longing throughout the whole Bible is so true, and it's a profound experience to long. And it's a profound experience that you got to experience, that maybe your friends in your Bible study did. And it's a beautiful place to, like, be comforted by the Father in that place of longing. And I did not trade that for anything, because it is well worth that desire to be comforted by the Father.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, a little bit what you were talking about, if we go back to the picture of Gethsemane, of Jesus, you know, there's this idea that we have a good Father who delights over His children and longs to give them the desires of their hearts. But we also, in this fallen world, have a Savior who has felt the sting of asking for a cup to be taken away, and it hasn't been taken away, who sat and who wept in the garden, and who then sits and weeps with us, next to us. I was talking with a student, I had a student one time, I don't remember specifically what we were talking about, but she was going through a really difficult time, and I said, you know, Jesus is next to you in this. Jesus is next to you in this. And she said, he's not sitting next to me. I am down in a dark pit, and he's in this pit with me. Mm-hmm. And his knees are as dirty as mine are. And I was like, yes! Yes, that is it. You know, and so you see this picture, especially it's the Garden of Gethsemane on the cross, and that it's the both and, right? It's a Father whose love is so big for us that even on our knees, in the bottom of the dark, muddy pit, Jesus is there with us, and there is a promise that life will come from that, that life will come from ashes. Yeah.
Two thoughts related to desire. One is, if God gives us the desire of our heart the way that we want them in our schedule and time, we want them to be fulfilled, even what I would call the holy desires, seem very biblical and honoring the Lord, then we don't really need him. Mm-hmm. And I think God does something powerful, like you were saying, in that time of waiting and longing that draws us to him. We cling to him. He's mm-hmm. our only hope and answer, unless we just want to give up on hope altogether.
Yeah.
So there's just something really powerful in that. That's not an easy place mm-hmm. to come to. I mean, I think there's kind of a fight. You know, we struggled with infertility for 6 years, mm-hmm. and so that was a dark, dark time. I was kind of kicking and screaming, mm-hmm. coming to the place of really trusting Jesus in that. And then another thought that I had in the experiences with our infertility, and it relates to C.S. Lewis' quote as well, is God has desires for us that are beyond our imagination. Mm-hmm. So we desire children. That's a great thing. We want to grow our family and raise Christian children. And I had plans and dreams, and those dreams, you know, his youngest sister gets pregnant and has her first grandchild. Mm-hmm. It was another dream, you know. And felt like I was just getting knocked down over and over again. And then eventually this teenager and her 7-month-old boy come and live with us. And they live with us for 3 years, and their life has dramatically changed. Mm-hmm. And I would never have come up with that as mm-hmm. saying a trip to prayer for mm-hmm. growing our family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I wasn't embracing it like this is the answer.
Right, sure.
More just being obedient. And now, looking back, I'm just like in awe of God. Like, had a desire for this teenager and her son, but even for us, that was beyond mm-hmm. what I could imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you talked about the promise of in death, the promise of resurrection. I'm just struck by how frequently in the Bible there are situations and plans that look like they're dead on the vine, and God shows up, does something, like walk around the city. I mean, you know, these things that just seem so weird, and it's like, this is not what we need right now. What we need is this. And then, but it works out. God shows up, and there's this more, and one of the things that I love about this painting, I mean, that painting is a visual picture of what you're talking about. You know, the disciples did not know what was going on. They had walked with Jesus. They had listened, yes, 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 yes. And they didn't know what was going on. He was crucified. He was taken away. They still didn't get it. They were still looking for a particular kind of king. And you know, that the scripture about them coming to the tomb and Mary coming to the tomb and John and Peter and that, like, you think about that, like, wait, what? You know, like, what is happening? And that is really, I mean, what God is in the business of, not for the sake of dazzling us and being a magician and being a showman, but the sense of showing us that His ways are not our ways, and that also His ways are higher than our ways. I just love this. I'm like, I mean, to me, it's a prayer of like, God, help that be the posture of my body. That be the posture of, you know, the look on my face. Yeah. Nikki, sorry.
And you had that, you know, art being human side up there.
Yeah.
And in being human, he talks about how the essence of our spiritual experience is the recovery of our humanity,
mm-hmm.
and how part of how we see God is the place where we are being restored and resurrected.
Yeah.
That means our desires and, you know, looking for the way your humanity has been recovered in your story,
mm-hmm.
and how your desires are, you're part of your humanity, and those are such a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So to be in a mindset of these are good things, mm-hmm. and that they are being restored, mm-hmm. so the longing, you know, to be loved, and for empathy. These are all such good things,
yep.
and it is only in our humanity and our relationship with Christ that those become good desires and not broken.
Mm-hmm.
With the continuity from the garden through the fall, like,
mm-hmm.
these are so good things,
mm-hmm.
and they
mm-hmm.
should not be ignored,
mm-hmm.
and they need to be seen as good things,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, experience the churches where you just don't have that desire. You're not telling the whole story.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the goodness of God.
Yeah.
We long to be known. And
yeah.
We long to be loved. And we long to have this. Like, mm-hmm. this is because of God's goodness, mm-hmm. not His. You know, mm-hmm. because He's not, you know, shaking His fist or laughing at
us. Right. Yeah. Yeah, in Teach Us to Want, that's one of the things that just really struck me in Jen Pollock Michelle's book, this idea of, like, telling the truth, that is the place to start. I just really loved that. And it made me, that reminds me, Nikki, one of the things I thought of, I didn't put it in the lecture, but something we say a lot around here, a quote by Hans Rupmacher, who was a Dutch art historian who started the Dutch Libri, but he said, you know, Jesus didn't come to make us Christian. He came to make us human.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he didn't come to fit us into a, like, you know, mold, but to make us full and embodied, and our desires are so much a part of that. And that's why He came. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh,
good. Just try a thought that I've found helpful. Gets it in this largest theological framework, but in a way, the word glory is, I think, an important word. God is God of glory. Glory, Lord God, means His excellence in every conceivable area of His existence. We, and this is in 2 Corinthians, as you quoted, well, is we are able to grow as we become Christ-like from one degree of glory to another. Unbelievable to think that, that something, the glory of God, and again, we kind of think of it in the backdrop of what Hollywood has made of glory, Madison Avenue has made of glory.
Yeah.
We've got to completely retool the notion of glory, but the redemption of glory, the redemption of our imagination is really important. But this, what real glory is, will help us focus the best desires and also cope with the non-fulfillment of the desires. I mean, I've tried to tie it to the idea of what is heroic. What's glorious is what is heroic.
Yeah.
It represents real greatness.
and which, of course, is focused in Christ-likeness. Mm-hmm. And to think of retooling the idea of glory so that humility is heroic, which is what we need to do.
Yeah.
And but it just completely makes a hash of the idea of glory that's propagated in society. But I think that it makes room for the human, but also strains and stretches our quest, you know, what can be a quest for excellence in the areas that matter most, which is our character. So that's a much bigger thing than we can get at, but it's an interesting idea still nonetheless. Sort of overall framework being we're really allowed to deal with the glory of God in our own in our own growth, in our own experience. And actually grow toward it.
Yeah. It reminds me of the thing that you talk about sometimes. It's been really helpful to me of for when people are who are standing outside of the Christian faith looking in and the idea of becoming a Christian and the fear that becoming a Christian means, you know, I become essentially a paper doll or a cookie cutter cutout that a Christian looks like this and I have to fit into that mold versus this idea that when we come into Christ, yes, where the idea is for all of us to come to look more like Christ and to image Him, but we're going to do that in such profoundly different ways that I'm going to be imaging Jesus in a very Mary Frances kind of a way, and you're going to be imaging Jesus in a very Dick kind of way that has to do with the very unique ways that He's made us, that include not. Yeah, I was going to say it's not just our gifts and our talents, but our eccentricities, our character, our personality, our longings, our desires, all of that. And he uses that to propel us toward Him, but it shapes in a very unique way. And I think that's a way, to me, that sort of His glory then comes alive and comes to fruition in us. Yeah. Abby?
Well, I mean, it's along the same lines. I think our culture that we're in right now is fixated on success. And it's fixated on all the things that come with success, money, fame, influence. And we're still in that culture as we approach God.
Yeah.
And so our failures, our deaths, we think of them as wrath. I can't put anything on my resume. But in fact, God makes us perfect through our weakness, so that His power is manifest in us, His glory is manifest. And like this picture here, the dividing the spirit from the body, I think there's something going on in our culture where we have turned this sort of self-made man idea of being so ambitious that you make it a reality, you make yourself into the person you think you want to be.
Yeah.
We've made it so big that we've lost track of the fact that when we're sitting in front of the television, we're probably scratching our butts. And we're very human. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the whole butt scratching thing is something that draws us all together as humans. Because everyone scratches their butt.
Yeah, I think that
it's not something that we would, you know, like, and that's a bad example.
Yeah.
That's
good. Well, and it, but I think that, I mean, what you were talking about before of like the self-made man, or you know, when that's the thing that's propelling us forward.
You hear this in churches.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that
I want to see the fruit of the spirit. If you don't show the fruit of the spirit in two weeks or 2 years,
yeah,
don't forget it.
Yeah.
They're not worth my time. Yeah. They're not my responsibility.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. One of the things we love at Libri is that we don't have any donors that we have to report statistics to at the end of the term or a year or whatever. But I was just going to say, I think that just reinforces, you know, my kind of little list at the end of practices is like woefully incomplete. But that's where I think those physical, tangible habits, liturgies, practices in our lives are so important because it's so easy to be pulled into that, you know.
Yeah.
And
We're invested.
Yeah, absolutely. And to feel like, yeah, yeah. And so we need these real kind of talismans in our lives to hold on to, you know, to continue to direct us back north, you know, that yeah. point of directing us back north. Yeah.
On that same subject, toward the end of your talk, you mentioned the prayer of something which I didn't hear clearly.
Oh, it was
prayer of examine.
The prayer of examine. Priya brought it up, and that was the first question. Yeah, E X A M E N.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. My I have a good friend who kind of does that prayer with her children at night. And they gave me a really helpful book on it. And my goddaughter said, we do this examination every night, and you need to do it too. And I was like, what? Wait, you do an examination? Like, I literally had this vision. I'm like, is she testing them at night? What's happening?
But,
exactly. It's a prayer of examine, but in her 7-year-old mind, it's examination. Joshua.
I just had a thought when you were talking about this approach to acknowledging desires and longings can be helpful in evangelism in some way. I think there's a moment where a lot of people are like, that's really cool that you believe those things. That's fine, you can believe that. I can believe whatever I want to believe.
No big deal.
Beliefs are up to the individual. But, and so, I mean, I think you should some hard work and some advertising, and advertising works because, you know, the desire is never ultimately satisfied. It's sort of, it's satisfied for a bit, but then you need more. It fades away, so you go back, you keep buying, and keep things going. But, yeah, just thinking of so much. Well, for some reason, I was thinking of this band that I listened to in high school that I will admit. This band called The Postal Service, and they have a song where it says, I want so badly to believe that there is truth that love is real. You know, which is part of the chorus. The song's called Clark Gable. It's talking about, like, watching a movie and seeing something that's unreal. But he knows. Even though he wants that, he knows that it doesn't actually exist. So, like, those are moments where kind of the, potentially, the veneer, but just sort of the, there's a crack in people where you see something deeper in them. People long for meaning, people long for desire, as well as they long for good jobs and healthy, you know, relationships and all of those other things. I just think this could be a helpful way to think about as we rub shoulders with a lot of people who it just seems like it would take an incredible work of the Holy Spirit for them to, like, you know, consider sort of Christian belief cognitively first, but maybe starting with these unmet desires in their own lives and then sort of work out in some way.
And I think that's the place that the when I was talking about the church a little bit, where the one side of, you know, the sort of one way that either actually or perceived, I mean, I think the perception outside of the church is that desires are bad, this idea that desires are bad and they're not to be dealt with and they're not to be taken to God and they're things to be ashamed of. And, you know, I mean, that idea that some of us are aware of within the church, people outside of the church, that is the perception as well. So.
Yeah, and just to be clear, not to present like Christianity as though, oh, you have all these desires, Jesus will meet them all if you come forward, but giving a story and a picture of the world and of people in the world that makes sense of that having these desires that are unmet, like, why are they there? What am I made for?
Yeah. It ties in with what Nikki was saying. The idea of, like, they're good and it's part of being human and God has come to redeem and restore those things. Anybody else? Yeah.
There are one other thing. I think a lot of this is also connected to our view of God. So if we view God as somebody who encourages desire or somebody who discourages it, that has a big impact. There's a lot of research now, Old Testament research, that's increasingly seeing Genesis 1 and 2 as the description of a temple. In the ancient Near East, a temple would have water flowing out of it. It would have a garden connected to it, representing God's fertility and abundance. And and the words used for Adam and Eve are the same words used for the duties of a priest in the Levitical temple to guard the garden is what a priest would do with the temple. So what's interesting though is the word Eden actually is the Hebrew word for delight.
Mm.
So God has created a temple called delight,
mm.
where his presence dwells, where he walks with the first Adam and Eve, and it actually says the waters flowed out of Eden into the garden. Mm. So it's like God's presence is flourishing the garden to have abundant life and fruitfulness. It's a place of delight. And then the theme keeps coming up. I just looked up Psalm 16, the last verse. Says, there it is. You will make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy.
Mm-hmm.
In your right hand there are pleasures forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea that God has created a garden called delight, and he's reestablished that temple, tabernacle, Israel, and now inside of us, we bear the glory of God inside of us now. His character and his nature and his creation from beginning to end was a place of delight, a place of fruitfulness and joy forever, pleasure forever. So I think we sometimes disassociate those things with God, and therefore we disassociate them with ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's changed how we achieve them. We do achieve them through dying and rising with Jesus, but the end goal is still the same,
mm.
is to have delight and pleasure forever at God's right hand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think the Buddhist idea of desire has affected Western culture anymore in the last 100 years?
Anybody else want to speak to that? I don't know a lot about Buddhism. Of the kind of
The idea that desire is
separating
pain and
mm-hmm.
death, and then if you get rid of desire, you
mm-hmm.
and one
I don't,
with everything.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
sure.
I mean,
people, for people who take Buddhism seriously in that whole direction, it's a huge, it's very broad. Mm-hmm. It's a Buddhist way to avoid suffering is to stop desiring.
Yeah.
And then that will end suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge collision with the Christian faith, which we want to say stop desiring the wrong things, but don't quit desiring.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying stop desiring. And that's, I think, a connection with Buddhism that we need to press them a bit. Do you really want to let loose? Because they don't really let go of all their desires, or at least the ones I've met. They're only holding on to ones that make them more human, and that they're not willing to let go. It's a real point of tension, I think, is you're moving toward a denying their, I think, intrinsic humanness, and the closer they get to their goal of being without desire. Because it's pretty hard to not desire to free yourself from desire for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just throws in, you know, connected with Buddhist thought, which is a lot of people do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to wrap us up. I'm hot. thank you guys very much for listening, for staying.